the situation in Haiti continues to worsen.
You basically are risking your life to go out on the street because you don't know when people are going to start shooting.
Famine in Gaza is imminent.
This is an entirely man-made disaster, and the report makes clear that it can be halted.
And striking the balance between free speech and posting dangerous misinformation on social media.
And so it's treating Facebook and these other platforms like they're subordinates. Would you do that to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Associated Press?
Today is Tuesday, March 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. The lawlessness in Haiti is getting worse. 24 people were found dead in a wealthy suburb of Haiti's capital on Monday. It's an area not usually subject to Haiti's violence. Power and water supplies are spotty at best, and there are reports of looting. Joining us now to talk about this is Sandra Lemaire of VOA's Creole Service. Tell us what's going on. What's the latest?
Bodies were found in a suburb of Port-au-Prince called Pétionville. This suburb is a wealthy suburb. And according to our reporter who went to the scene, there are 24 bodies found strewn about in the streets. Authorities say it was the gangs who killed these people. Our sources say that it's because they're on a rampage because a lot of the gang members of the G9 gang, which is now calling itself Vive Ensemble, Live Together, which is Barbecue, Jimmy Chouizier's gang, were killed.
It's unusual for this type of neighborhood, a wealthy upscale neighborhood, to be attacked, right?
Yes, it is. But the gangs have said that if they don't get what they want, which is they want a seat at the table of this transitional presidential council that CARICOM announced a plan for, that they will then just attack and continue going forward with their plan to take over the capital. So this is all part of their plan to make everyone take notice, and basically terrorize citizens so that people don't go against what they want.
So basically, at this point, there's no government, right?
We can't say that there isn't a government. There is, but is it functioning? No. So basically, the finance minister is in charge. His last name is Boisvert. He is the interim prime minister. Prime Minister Henri has said that he will resign once the transitional council is in place, which has not yet happened. So Ariane Henry is actually in charge until that council takes power.
Now, he's still in Puerto Rico, right? So what do we know of his situation there?
So we have asked and we've been digging around. And the only thing we know is that the White House confirmed for us when we asked John Kirby, said that we know he is in Puerto Rico. We had a reporter in San Juan last week. People told him that they heard that the prime minister was being held at some military base in San Juan. He went over there, spoke to the authorities. They told him that that's not true. He's not at the base. So we know he's in Puerto Rico. We don't know where he is in Puerto Rico. And we don't know how long he'll be in Puerto Rico either. We've asked all those questions and no one has given us an answer.
What are we looking at over the next couple of days?
It's really a crapshoot. We don't really know. The only thing we know for sure is things will probably get worse. There is Guy Philippe, a former senator from the South, the Grand'Anse, which is on the southern coast of Haiti, who has joined ranks with the gangs, and the gangs support him, and they told him and say publicly that they want him to be recognized as the president. They want him to lead a three-person council, and they're talking about basically inaugurating him rogue style at some point this week. Some people say it'll be tomorrow. Other people have said it might be Wednesday, but that's what they're planning. So the two plans for leadership are clashing with one another. And so it's left Haiti in a very volatile situation because, of course, if the gangs don't get their way, which the international community does not want them to have their way, then they'll just, they've said they're just going to start killing people.
As an average citizen just living there, it's been getting unbearable, right? Because nothing is being delivered to the island, food, gasoline, any kind of supplies, right?
It's really, really worrisome. And those of us who are Haitian Americans, who have family there, we are very worried about that situation because it's untenable, of course. You basically are risking your life to go out on the street because you don't know when people are going to start shooting, and you're just collateral damage to the gangs. They don't really care. And they've said that in their statements to the press. And then, of course, you know, for children, for the people who are ill, for, you know, people who need to maybe be hospitalized, it's really, I mean, even we've heard doctors, we visited the general hospital in Port-au-Prince, the doctors had run away because they're like, I'm not staying here. The gangs are coming. We don't know when they're going to be shooting everybody inside. And so it's just, I just don't know how people are getting by day to day.
VOA's Sandra Lemaire from our Creole service. In Gaza, new warnings that famine is imminent and likely to happen in May, first in northern Gaza, and then, as we hear now in this report from Reuters correspondent Lauren Anthony, it will likely spread across the enclave by July.
Outside a warehouse in Gaza City, crowds of Palestinians clamour for aid. But the meagre supplies currently reaching the enclave are nowhere near enough to sustain a population that a UN-backed report says is weeks away from famine, and that the number of people experiencing catastrophic hunger has risen to 1.1 million. That's around half of the population. Here's UN Chief Antonio Guterres.
Palestinians in Gaza are enduring horrifying levels of hunger and suffering. This is the highest number of people facing catastrophic hunger ever recorded by the Integrated Food Security Classification System, anywhere, anytime.
5 months of war have shattered the Palestinian territory, killed thousands, and cut off supplies. The Global Hunger Monitor said shortages in parts of the Gaza Strip have already far exceeded famine levels, adding that mass death is now imminent without an immediate ceasefire and a surge of food into areas cut off by fighting. Also on Monday, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell said Israel is provoking a famine, a claim Israel rejects.
Starvation is used as a weapon of war. Yes, starvation is used as a weapon of war.
The IPC reports came as Israeli forces launched a major overnight assault on battered Gaza City's Al-Shifa hospital, based on intelligence that the building was being used by senior Hamas leaders. Israel said it had killed 20 Hamas fighters, including a senior Hamas commander, Fayek al-Mabhu, in the hospital. It has repeatedly said it does not target civilians and is only interested in eliminating the militant Islamist group. The prospect of a man-made famine in Gaza has sparked the strongest criticism of Israel from Western allies since it launched its war against Hamas militants following their deadly attack on Israeli territory on October 7th.
Reuters correspondent Lauren Anthony. Polish and German battle groups will join Europe's rapid reaction forces in July as part of the EU's Strategic Compass plan. That's the European Union's equivalent to a military doctrine similar to the U.S.-led NATO's strategic concept, which outlines the alliance's goals. German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius.
Nobody really knows whether or when Russia will anybody attack in Europe, but what we really see is that it is able and willing to attack Ukraine and is doing it now for more than 2 years. So what we have to learn all together as allies in Europe is to be prepared for any threat, especially for a threat which comes from Putin's Russia in any year.
The Council of the European Union on Monday ratified an agreement to increase the EU's support for Ukraine's armed forces by $5.44 billion through a dedicated assistance fund. Unions and leftist groups led a march on Argentina on Monday to protest President Javier Milei's government cuts on social spending. There were clashes with riot police. U.S. President Joe Biden will host his Philippines counterpart, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida on April 11. It'll be the first three-way summit with the Asia-Pacific allies. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said the leaders would push a shared vision for a free and open Indo-Pacific, a key concern as regional tensions rise with China. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has overseen firing drills by artillery units in the western region involving newly equipped super-large multiple rocket launchers. All this according to the state media on Tuesday. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said on Monday that Washington was releasing the first guidance for tech companies to help prevent attacks on human rights defenders online.
Today, we're releasing first-of-its-kind guidance to give technology companies the tools to help prevent, mitigate, and seek justice for attacks on human rights defenders online. We're protecting access to a free and open internet.
Blinken is among senior officials from around the world attending the Summit for Democracy conference, which opened in Seoul. The summit is an initiative of U.S. President Joe Biden aimed at discussing ways to stop democratic backsliding and erosion of rights and freedoms worldwide. Blinken met his South Korean counterpart after attending the summit. They held a lunch meeting at South Korea's foreign ministry where they were expected to discuss bilateral issues, including ways to strengthen the South Korea-U.S. alliance, as well as regional and global issues. The United States said Monday it is not behind the protests in Cuba.
And the accusation of that is absurd.
President Miguel Díaz-Canel repeated a frequent accusation leveled by Havana that the United States was seeking to overthrow the island's communist-run government. Cuba's government confirmed that five protests had taken place across the island on Sunday. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Former President Donald Trump has so far been unable to obtain a bond that would allow him to appeal a $454 million judgment against him in a New York civil fraud case without posting the full amount himself, according to his lawyers. Reuters correspondent Chris Dignam has more.
The bond would allow Trump to appeal the more than $450 million he owes in penalties and interest, which a judge ordered him to pay last month for misstating property values to dupe lenders and insurers. Trump must either find the cash or post a bond to prevent the state's authorities from seizing his properties while he appeals the judge's decision. Trump's lawyers urged an appeals court to delay enforcement of the judgment, arguing the amount was excessive. They said Trump had so far approached 30 companies to obtain a bond, but that all have said no. Trump earlier this month posted a bond of nearly $92 million to cover an $83 million defamation verdict for the writer E. Jean Carroll while he appeals that judgment. Trump denied wrongdoing in the civil fraud case, as he has in all of his current legal battles, which include four criminal indictments.
Reuters correspondent Chris Dignam. For years, China has sought to raise its profile by offering to broker conflicts and disputes in the Middle East. But analysts say Beijing's limited involvement in the Gaza war shows China continues to put its self-interests first. Dale Gavlak explains.
In a recent article in Foreign Policy magazine, Yun Sun, China program director at the Stimson Center in Washington, said that China's role in brokering the Saudi-Iran rapprochement last year raised hopes it could chart a way to de-escalate tensions in the Middle East. Instead, she said, China has not delivered on that success. Sun and other analysts point to China's huge dependence on Gulf crude oil for its economy, and with 53% of its energy needs coming from the region, Beijing sees Middle East stability as paramount. Hisham Al-Ghanem heads the Strategic Studies and National Security Programs at Naif Arab University for Security Sciences in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. He praised China's shared views with Arab states, including promoting a ceasefire early in the Gaza conflict. Yet Al-Ghanem added that Chinese political involvement in the Middle East remains limited.
The Middle East is not a fundamental interest of China, and no one should exaggerate, I think, the Chinese power and role in the Middle East. Similar to the U.S., China lacks a comprehensive security strategy that addresses the main security challenges of the region.
Ahmed Aboudo, an associate fellow with London's Chatham House Middle East program, said in a report that China pressured Iran over Houthi attacks in the Red Sea, but only to protect its own ships. China's efforts were focused exclusively on extracting guarantees to protect China's direct interests. China's threats resulted in the Houthis granting Chinese and Russian ships immunity. China has adopted a low-risk, wait-and-see approach. Professor Degan San directs Middle East studies at China's Fudan University in Shanghai. He told an online Chatham House panel that China sees the rise of non-state actors like the Houthis as a direct threat to its interests in the Middle East, as it is its largest investment and trading partner.
Therefore, China says the U.S. cannot leave the Middle East. The Middle East needs the U.S. because it can be a stabilized force for China and the rest of the world.
He adds that Beijing wants to send a signal to the U.S. that China is not a U.S. rival, but a U.S. partner in Middle Eastern governance, and that the rise of non-state actors in the Mideast region is the outcome of a governance deficit. A deficit Sun believes the U.S. and China can fill through cooperation in Middle Eastern security affairs. Dale Gavlak, VOA News.
And finally, the complexity of free speech. It's easy to say there's free speech in a nation, but balancing the right of free speech and keeping people safe is a very fine line. My brother used to say, he was a police officer in the U.S. city of Miami, he used to say, it's easy to police in a police state. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has taken a case in which this is being tested. Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen reports that the Biden administration is appealing a lower court's preliminary injunction constraining how the White House and certain other federal officials communicate with social media platforms.
The case concerns efforts by the Biden administration to press sites such as Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter to remove posts the White House deemed misinformation, primarily about COVID-19 vaccines and the 2020 election. But Republican-led states Missouri and Louisiana, along with five individual social media users, sued, claiming this amounted to an infringement on freedom of speech. Here's Louisiana Solicitor General Benjamin Aguinaga.
But the government has no right to persuade platforms to violate Americans' constitutional rights. And pressuring platforms in back rooms shielded from public view is not using the bully pulpit at all. That's just being a bully.
The Biden administration countered that it was exercising its right to request the removal of what it believed to be content that harmed public health. saying it would do the same for content that it deemed racist or anti-Semitic. Here's Justice Department lawyer Brian Fletcher.
I think it's really troubling, the idea that those sorts of classic bully pulpit exhortations, public statements urging actors to behave in different ways, might be deemed to violate the First Amendment.
Questions posed by some of the justices focused on whether the plaintiffs had proper legal standing to sue and how the government had caused harm. Conservative Justice John Roberts said that the government is not monolithic.
I suspect when there's pressure put on one of the platforms or certainly one of the other media outlets, they have people they go to, probably in the government, to say, hey, they're trying to get me to do this, and that person may disagree with what the government's trying to do this. It's not monolithic, and that has to dilute the concept of coercion significantly, doesn't it?
While liberal Justice Elena Kagan wondered whether the government was allowed to intercede in cases where content could cause harm.
These platforms, they're compilers of speech. And some part of the government, let's call it part of the law enforcement arm of the government, says you might not realize it, but you are hosting a lot of terrorist speech, which is going to increase the chances that there's going to be some terrible harm that's going to take place. And we want to give you this information. We want to try to persuade you to take it down. The government can't do that.
However, conservative Justice Samuel Alito expressed alarm at the pressure administration officials applied to social media platforms to target misinformation.
And so it's treating Facebook and these other platforms like they're subordinates. Would you do that to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Associated Press or any other big newspaper or wire service?
A lower court sided with the plaintiffs. The Supreme Court's ruling is expected by the end of June.
Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen. This has been International Edition of The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for being with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. And you can download the VOA app. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Joe Biden has directed the U.S. military to lead a mission establishing a temporary pier on the coast of Gaza to bring much-needed assistance to Palestinians as the war between Israel and Hamas continues. The United States is coordinating efforts to open and run the maritime corridor with colleagues from the United Kingdom, the UAE, Qatar, the European Union, the United Nations, and Israel, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
When established, this corridor will enable the distribution of up to 2 million meals every single day, as well as medicine, water, and other critical humanitarian supplies. Germany, Greece, Italy, the Netherlands, Canada are also supporting this effort.
Secretary Blinken said the maritime corridor is part of our all-of-the-above strategy to make sure that we're doing everything possible by every means possible to surge support to those who need it, by land, by sea, by air. Right now, Secretary Blinken said, humanitarian assistance through Rafah and Kerem Shalom are returning to levels that were in place some weeks ago, about 200 trucks a day. In addition, the first aid shipments have gotten to North Gaza through a new crossing at the 96th gate, and flour has been released from Ashdod port. Positive movement, Secretary Blinken declared, but still insufficient.
Israel still needs to open as many access points as possible and keep them open to make sure that things are flowing in a sustainable way. We need to see flooding the zone when it comes to humanitarian assistance for Gaza.
Secretary Blinken insisted, however, that the most effective way to really get that done is with a ceasefire. The United States continues to work intensely with Israel, with Qatar, with Egypt on a ceasefire proposal. The question is, does Hamas want to end the suffering that it's provoked? He asked. Ensuring the supply of humanitarian assistance, doing everything possible to protect civilians, has to be a priority, declared Secretary Blinken. We look to the government of Israel to make sure that this is a priority. That has to be job number one, even as they do what is necessary to defend the country and to deal with the threat posed by Hamas.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.